as I understand it, Microsoft developed it to the point where we handed it off to a nonprofit.
Mm-hmm.
And so now is that nonprofit taking over those designs and those artifacts and producing it for visually impaired children?
Yes, exactly. So that was an interesting story and a lovely collaboration. As Microsoft research, we had the ability to do the kind of we're very well prepared to do the research and the design of the system. We took it one step further, and we saw it's not enough for us to come up with this idea, to do the research, and then to publish a paper about it. That's nice, but where does that get us? We could write a paper about it, and then we would be telling other people how to make something like this. But telling other people is just part of the problem. You need actually so much of the work comes in, how do you engineer it properly so that it actually works? How do you make it cost effective for someone to be able to hold it? So the problem is beyond one of a research design. It starts being into engineering and logistics and distribution, all those things right. Need to align for this to really make a change in the world. And so we were very driven from early on. As soon as we started seeing that it was traction, that we wanted to find a route to make an impact in the world with this beyond just the idea. So we did that in a couple of ways. And initially, we were having such good results in the lab, but the real litmus test for us was, would this actually be work for teachers in classrooms, in a real classroom setting, when right. we're not there, and they're actually having to teach in their chaos and the complication of a classroom. So we got some funding actually from Jenny Le Fleury, who's our Microsoft's chief accessibility officer, to build a beta deployment of 50 kits. So it doesn't sound like a lot, but bear in mind a kit contains 20 different pieces, and which is hundreds of electronic components and dozens of different bits of plastic. It's actually quite a complicated thing. So we took that opportunity to do two things. One is we built up a number of kits, and as we were doing that, we had to go through all the kind of product development process that is involved. These things need to be more robust than a one-off prototype. They need to work in a classroom setting. So we took the opportunity to do all that upfront work and bring the design to a level of robustness and completion that you don't usually see in kind of research prototypes. And then once we had them, we deployed them across the UK with 50 different schools, a whole range of geographical, socioeconomic backgrounds. And we got overwhelmingly positive children, and we just got back so many good stories about children that had previously been excluded from a classroom and from a computer science class. Now they were able to kind of participate with peers. We worked with colleagues to in education to develop a curriculum around this that dovetailed with the UK curriculum. So you were actually teaching the same concepts as on a day by day basis. Like when someone's teaching, the concept of variables using Scratch or Python or whatever they're using in the regular classrooms, this is how you teach it with this. So that was another super humbling experience. The technology is part of it, but it's a tool. And what we really need is, it's the teachers are the ones that teach. learning what everything that goes into kind of creating those lesson plans and explaining, and like, how do you explain things, and how do you package things up, and how do you enable people to solve their own problems? All the documentation and teaching material, the creation of teaching materials was fascinating to me. So anyway, we took all of that and we ended up with this package that was on one hand, set of teaching materials and this tool and this design. And then we wanted it to put it out in the world. And that is an interesting challenge because, back to my earlier point, sometimes there are problems that can really benefit from a little bit of technology. But in this case, the challenge was the market size by, compared to like the market for smartphones is tiny. But it makes a huge difference, to that small group of people. This poses an interesting problem because problems like that, who's going to solve them? A startup is not going to be able to solve a problem like that because where is the revenue stream going to come from? The investment, this was kind of 2 years of research and development. That's going to be really hard to recoup. Plus all the kind of upfront investment in creating just like the tooling for the injection molding and the design of the circuit boards and all of those things. So it's also a big company is not going to do it. A startup is not going to do it. The capabilities might be present in something like a university lab. The kind of research capabilities and people do design and create systems like this, but they fall short of, there's only so far that you can do if you're in an academic setting. You don't necessarily have the luxury of, just taking a year out to develop a product. So it was fascinating to me too that we actually found ourselves in a unique position where we had like the ability to develop this, resolve it, and then in order to get it out, where we ended up signing to talk to an organization called the American Printing House for the Blind, which is a fascinating organization. If you haven't come across it, they're headquartered in Louisville in Kentucky. It's this kind of old building. Right in the middle of the city, and they've been there for I think over 100 years, and they have these old printing presses where they make braille books, additional materials and resources, and they have been for decades the source of a lot of the materials that if you need to get a textbook in braille or an audiobook, they are the people that do it and that get like all those materials into schools. They have this catalog that lists all the tools that you might need and resources, surface relief maps and all sorts of fascinating things that I didn't even know existed. So we found in them a really good partner in that they had the connection with schools and the ability to and the remit to bring solutions like this into classrooms. Yep. So as Microsoft, what we ended up doing was kind of donated the design and the we contributed the design and the research and the manufacturing line that we worked with a company in China, Seed Studio, to set up a little production line for these things, and we kind of handed that over, and they took over a CodeJumper as a product owner, it's now their product, and they put it out, so it's powered by Microsoft.
Oh wow, that's great. So as you were talking about all of these pieces, and you know, will flash an image or a small video, what it looks like. I'm curious, just as someone who knows a little bit of programming, one of the biggest challenges in programming is you write something and things don't go well. Mm-hmm. And then it says, oh, here's an error, here's what you did wrong. So just real quick, could you share with at least some of our technical audience, when something goes wrong with CodeJumper, how do you pinpoint, how do you tell the students, this is the module that's not working? Does it buzz? Does it beep? Like, what happens? How do you get feedback?
Okay, so the output of a CodeJumper program is always audio. So what you're actually programming is you're putting these things together and you're creating a song or a poem, or you know, you're programming to say a particular sequence of things in an order. So this is important to understand that, I guess, as a background. So normally an error message, there are what we call, there are kind of two types of errors. One error, kind of unintentional things. You know, you program it, but your program doesn't work as you intended. And there are what we call syntax errors, where it's just the set of instructions is invalid. Like, there is no way for the computer to even interpret these, because you have made the structure of the program is fundamentally wrong. I can't do anything, not even wrong. And that's a syntax for error. And in our system, you know, it burps. There is a big burping sound, and that's how you know that something's wrong. Now, a really important thing, the important thing is, how do you fix them? And it was one of the lessons that I learned through doing this, is you don't want to do too much you don't want to make it so that, what do I want to say about this? It is important to have the ability to make errors, I guess, is the important lesson. We could have designed it in such a way that there wasn't even the possibility of creating a syntax error, that whatever you did was valid. But it was very important that things don't work, because that empowers a student to learn about debugging as a process, and the process of finding out where the error is. So there's actually a lot of the metrics of success and how you measure progress is, one of the things is how good are they about understanding where, you know, following that process that allows you to sort of say, okay, it must be here. So I'm going to separate my program into two parts. Does this part work, and does this part work? And if they, okay, no, this is the part that's not working, so the problem must be around here. And you sort of delve deeper, and that whole problems of like process of identifying the fault and probing it and exploring and debugging is really important. I actually love like when students start like talking about debugging.
That's fascinating.
They walked away with, yeah.
And sounds like that combined with the teacher, the instructor around the students, completely closes the loop, and they can learn quickly.
Absolutely.
This is really, really fascinating work you did, Nick, with CodeJumper. Thank you so much for making all of us proud, and you know, helping, like you said, helping the small community. But with technology, and it's such a big uplift for that small set of people. And it's not that small. I know we are relatively speaking and we keep calling it small, but it's a lot of people who would love to have programming and software careers, but have been held back because of their visual impairments. So kudos on that, thank you.
Thank you.
I know we are coming up on time, and I wanted to just quickly have the audience learn a little bit of what you are doing nowadays. Mm-hmm. So as I understand, you're working on a system which will be deployed around the world, and to put it in one manner, it will be an early warning system for pandemics.
Exactly.
And epidemics. So do you just want to briefly touch upon kind of that work? And I'm sure, you know, we can deep dive in a subsequent interview. Sure. But what is that work, and what do you plan on achieving with it?
So the project that you're talking about is called Microsoft Premonition, and it's a fascinating effort to build the, and like you say, an early warning system for pandemics. So we're kind of trying to do, I think, the equivalent of putting up the satellite system that monitors the weather to be able to predict the next hurricane, but we want to do that for infectious diseases. And the approach when I first learned about it, I was really fascinated by it. I joined the project a couple of years after it had started. And when Ethan Jackson, who leads the project, started to explain to me, it had the makings of that, you know, one of those situations where a little bit of technology can have a huge impact for a huge number of people. And because, as we all know, like infectious diseases and pandemics are a very real thing that affects us as a planet.
Indeed.
And the particular approach is so ingenious and fascinating. So the idea is to monitor the biome and the ecosystem for early warning signs of diseases that might be maybe we haven't even seen before, or something that we're on the lookout for resurgence. And we do that by putting out what we call robotic entomologists, which are robotic devices that we put up in the field, and they interact mostly with insects. That's why we call them entomologists, because the insects are a really good proxy for the health of the environment. And particularly things that, like mosquitoes, which are blood feeding insects, you know, they will go around and they will bite everything. They will bite humans and mammals, anything that contains nutritious blood flow protein, they will go and bite, and then they will carry that in their abdomen. And if we're able to catch them and analyze the genetic contents of the mosquito, now we have a tiny snapshot of what organisms are in the environment and what organisms might be contained in the blood of those organisms. We can do things like find pathogens in the blood of something like a human or a cow that a mosquito has bitten.
And if you do this on a wide enough scale, the idea is that you can use these, for instance, mosquitoes or ticks, mm-hmm. other insects as proxy for getting a signal of what's happening in the biome and what pathogens, what infectious diseases are upcoming, etc.
Exactly. And that's a really good point. Like, one of the keywords is scalable monitoring of the environment is what we're really interested in, like building the devices that will allow us to do this at a wide enough scale that we get enough data points, and we create these data streams that we can then feed into the cloud, do all the like amazing machine learning on the genetic sequences that are extracted from this biological information. And being able to find all those needles in the haystack, saying, oh, wait, I'm seeing some virus that looks like this. It looks like something that we've seen before, but it's a little bit different, and we're kind of seeing a resurgence of it in this area.
That's
the ultimate goal, yeah.
That's fascinating. Wonderful. Thank you for sharing that project, and feels like we need to go in depth on it in a subsequent chat. So I know we're short on time, and I wanted to make sure we get, especially for our emerging leaders, we have a question for you, which is, looking back at your work and your kind of current work, what are some of the key learnings that you wanted to share with kind of young leaders, emerging leaders, or what would you tell yourself, you know, 15 years younger? What learnings you want to share with our audience?
I guess one thing that I've learned is that having an idea is great, but like the way you change the world is by seeing it through. And a little bit like we talk with CodeJumpers, doing the research is an important part of it. But if you have the, if you really want to change the world, you have to find that path, to strive for that path, to solve all the hundreds of little problems that stand between the idea and the result of your idea in people's hands, like that iteration. And it is it's a lot of hard work. It's not a technological, most of the even for technological artifacts, most of the problems are not technological. They're human, they're financial, logistical. But it is so worth doing. There is nothing as satisfying as following something from idea through that execution to the
final. That's wonderful learning. Thank you for sharing that. I love that. So yeah, idea is not enough. You have to see it through for it to have impact. Mm-hmm. That's amazing. Awesome. With that, Nick, I wanted to thank you again for hopping on IdeaGen TV. This was amazing. I learned a lot. Code Jumper seems like it's already changing the world, and you are now working on something, you know, that could possibly prevent future pandemics and economic and life loss of human life like we are seeing right now. So thank you for your work, and thank you for hopping on this chat.
Thank you for having me. It's been so much fun to chat with you about all of this.
Thanks, Nick.
Take care.